I was almost born happy. That's the opening sentence to The Spanish Bow by Andromeda Romano Lax, her first novel, a novel loosely based on, whose main character is loosely based on Pablo Casal, the famous cellist. And we have Andromeda with us this morning to talk about The Spanish Bow. Good morning.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks a lot for coming down here. Wonderful book, very rich novel, full of great characters and interesting themes. It's kind of hard to figure out where to get started, but I think for me, one of the things that was interesting is, of course, obviously Pablo Casal, who the main character is loosely based on, is an interesting individual, particularly from the perspective of the challenges he faced and how he responded to those challenges in the 1930s and 40s. And this book really does sort of explore that whole question of the role of art and politics. And perhaps you'd like to talk a little bit about why you chose that particular aspect to deal with in your first novel.
Sure. Well, I guess I have to go back about 6 years ago to 9/11. That really was the starting point for me. I'd spent many years writing nonfiction and journalism. I was mostly a travel writer. And I was actually just getting started on another book that had some marine environmental issues and about the changing North Pacific and, you know, an important, tough subject. Well, then 9/11 happened, and there was this feeling of that I think we all had for a little while of, you know, if I could only do one thing, what would it be? You know, if I'd been on that plane or in that building, or if something happened to me in the next year, what's the thing I would really like to have done and left behind? So the science writing I was doing was very important, but it seemed less immediate. It also seemed kind of depressing. It was lacking that human story, that human face. So, you know, I can say that I thought readers needed a more human story. I think I, deep inside myself, needed a more human heroic story to tell. So I set aside that plan to write, in, you know, a depressing environmental book that probably very few people would have wanted to read right then. And I said, what do I want to write about? And I've loved the cello since I was about 6 years old. I played off and on as a child, and then I restarted about 9 years ago as an amateur adult. So I'm still very much an amateur, but I'm absolutely passionate about the cello. And I knew I'd always wanted to write about the cello, but now, again, I had that need for a heroic story. So that led me directly to Casals, whose life I knew a little about. And Casals was a Spanish cellist. He is one of our most famous cellists, actually one of the most famous classical musicians of the last century. He was from Spain, but he spent the end of his life in Puerto Rico. So Puerto Rico is where I headed, and spent some time at a museum dedicated to him and looking through archives and, you know, watching footage of him perform. He was famous as a cellist, but you're referring to the politics. He was actually more famous as a humanitarian. Mm-hmm. Some of the things he did, he for some years refused to perform in any country that recognized Franco, the dictator. And Casals himself refused to return to Spain until democracy was restored, which did not happen in his lifetime. Both Casals and Franco died in the 70s, so they were both very long-lived. You know, they made it. They were. Trying to outlast each other, I'm not sure. But in any case, so that was the heroic story that I thought I would be telling in nonfiction form. And then what ended up happening, much to my surprise, because I'd never planned on writing a novel, was that the more I learned about this whole big picture of how do musicians and composers and visual artists deal with political challenges, the more it seemed not like Casal's story, but almost everyone's story. Especially in the 1900s. It seemed like if you were famous, this was an issue you were going to have to deal with. Mm-hmm. You know, did you support governments or dictators? Did you actually express politics through your music or art? Or did you at some point set your music and art aside because it didn't seem as important as being even more explicitly political? And it just seemed like a real struggle for everyone during that time. And there's parallels to today as well. I mean, it's an issue that never really goes away.
Right, right. Well, and I think you do a wonderful job in terms of sort of laying that whole discussion out. And it's interesting, in the course of doing that, you managed to introduce some of the most amazing artistic figures of the period. I mean, we have Picasso, Kurt Weill, et cetera. Did you have to spend much time doing research into those individuals as well, or did you just you know, how did you go about deciding to people it that way in such what I thought was a very realistic manner?
Oh, well, thank you. Most of these stories were new to me, actually. Most of this whole subject was new to me. So as I was researching the period, you know, I just came across lots of examples, could not use them all. There were so many, but particular lives and situations kind of jumped into my attention. So, you know, Kurt Weill just happened to be involved with a specific odd little opera that had a political message that I weave into a subplot, you know, kind of an obscure work he was doing. And then Picasso's Guernica had really direct relevance. That was another example of an artist who, on the liberal side, was pressured to create something that really could have been seen as propaganda for the World's Fair that was held in Paris. The Spanish Republicans in exile wanted him to create a piece of art that would tell their side of the story. And he was resistant at first for, I think, reasons that we can understand. He didn't want to just be sort of a poster propagandist. But then Guernica was bombed. This is a village in northern Spain. And suddenly then he had a subject and he created this incredible masterpiece, which I only saw when I was doing research for this book. I got to see it live in Madrid. And, you know, so while I was doing the research, I just kept finding new stories and new people. And maybe the hardest part was to cut it off at some point, to not include absolutely everybody in that fantastic, vivid era.
Right. Who didn't make the list?
Yes. Who didn't make the list? Edith Piaf, the singer.
I know. I was wondering about that. And
yeah, that was one person where I thought, well, here we are again with somebody who is in this situation. The Nazis are coming close. Seems like the Nazis in particular. This story was really focused more on Spain, and I had to be careful. Mm-hmm. Some of it goes to Germany, but I couldn't let too much of it go to Germany because that's an area we kind of know more about through movies and everything. But boy, a lot of the famous Nazis loved their classical music and their popular music, and you know, so they had their hands in everything. So yeah. I had to be careful there not to have too many characters that were cozy with the Nazis, but there were a lot of them.
Did you... coming from a journalist and travel writing background, did you find it easy to sort of slip into the heads of not just your main character, but the other characters involved to sort of recapture the, you know, what it was like to be living during that period?
Was it easy? I'm not sure if it was easy, but it sure was entertaining and it felt really good. I mean, I think as a journalist, the difficulty is that you're always looking for a great story, a story that can be more than just journalism, but can be fully dramatic, that you can almost tell in a fictional way with dialogue and motivation. And the danger, that was the kind of features writing I did, where I really tried to get deeply into the heads of people. And the danger as a journalist is that sometimes you're looking for such a good story that there is some, you know, there's a internal pressure to make the story even better, you know, to say, well, what if, and wouldn't it be neat if this also happened? And, mm-hmm. and then we start getting our kind of fuzzy journalism, fuzzy creative nonfiction that gets a little too creative. So for me, it was just fantastic to jump just fully into the fictional world where I could be using real people as inspiration, but then I could take it a different direction. If I needed somebody to have a personal experience, you know, I didn't just have to fuzz the boundaries. I could just imagine completely. And I loved it so much, that's what I hope to continue doing.
Did you find yourself in the course of, you know, operating within the environment of a novel, did you find yourself kind of, whoa, I can't be doing this, I'm fudging facts, or I'm, you know, did you kind of have a feeling that you needed to be adhering to certain facts, or?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I tried to kind of have two different worlds operating, one with the minor characters where I tried to stay closer to fact. So it's not just the people that we kind of know, like Picasso and, you know, scenes that have already been documented where I tried to stick to that, because I know when I read, I like to know, did this really happen? But then there were other characters that are also based on fact that most of us don't know much about, like the Queen of Spain at the time, Queen Ana, who was the granddaughter of Queen Victoria. Fascinating woman, fascinating character that I'd never known anything about. Because she came from Great Britain, she was a real outsider, even as the Spanish queen. And in fact, talk about getting back to the politics, there was as much terrorism and all that going on in the early part of the century as there is now. And on her wedding day, someone tried to assassinate Queen Ana and King Alfonso, her new husband. And after the attempted assassination that left them spattered with blood, in her first public appearance, she appeared very calm. And from what I read, that was one of the things that did not endear her to the Spanish public. They wanted to see her more dramatic, you know, maybe more of a Princess Di figure who would get upset or something. And instead, she was completely stoic and calm, and that started off her reputation as kind of a frigid woman that people could not relate to.
Stiff British upper lip was not the right response.
Yes, she should have fainted a little bit and cried out to the people over the balcony or something. So those were the kind of facts that I wanted to keep real, but then I also wanted to fictionalize. I wanted to create situations imagining, well, behind closed doors, how would this seemingly stoic, frigid woman act if she had a young musician, a young cellist, my character Feliu, someone with whom she could open up a little bit more. And in this story, it's through listening to music that she has her few moments when she can let loose a little bit. So yeah, I was always operating between those two worlds, wanting to keep some of the facts intact and then wanting to wander into areas where I could imagine.
Now, and Feliu, I mean, loosely based on Pablo Casal, but you've created a freestanding entity in this, a character in this book. I mean, it's not just mirroring Casal's life. Did you, how did that process go about for, I mean, you have an inspiration in mind, but then how do you manage to sort of craft it so it's a standalone entity?
Well, I tell the story chronologically, and so I start with him as a young boy. And as you said, it was originally inspired by Casals, but the thing I do need to remind people is it's really not him. I mean, even the time period has shifted so that Casals lived. He was born quite a bit earlier and so had different interactions with historical figures, historical events. So even the time period has adjusted a little bit. But when you start with somebody as a boy and start sort of building the character from the ground up, and then put him into situations or put him into a historical context where things happen to him, it just seems to happen naturally. You know, what would happen to this young boy who, from the first time he hears the cello, is absolutely in love with it, but who's living in very difficult times, who sees his mom, his mother, courted by, you know, kind of dangerous men in their small town, and who goes on to have a tutor in Barcelona who's kind of a leftist anarchist with a mysterious background, you know, that even our young Feliu may not agree with, and just putting him into different situations and seeing what kind of person would this create.
Mm-hmm.
So it just grew naturally.
One of the themes, I mean, this book is full of fascinating themes. One that I found interesting throughout was sort of put forward the discussion of how much is our life sort of controlled by some sort of destiny. Because Feliu, for example, his entire life gets changed by the introduction of the Spanish bow.
Yes.
And then how much of it is as a result of our actions, or is there some middle ground where it's an interplaying between these outside forces and our own self-determination? And, what was your thought for wanting to make that such a core of the novel?
Sure. Well, I think you're right. I think it is an interplay, so much so that I can't really even tell what my feelings are on the subject. I come at it through story, you know, because it's complex. So Feliu does receive this bow, which is a gift from, it's a posthumous gift from his father who was working abroad in Cuba and dies. And then this box of items comes. From those items, Feliu chooses the bow. So we have both the notion of destiny and also the notion of choice. And then throughout the story, things get added to the bow. For example, the queen, in trying to kind of recognize him, gives him a gemstone that gets put into the frog of the bow. Well, he earned that gemstone through some of the choices that he made, but then sort of metaphorically, it weighs on him, this feeling of now he's obligated to do even more for her, or so he feels. So it's this constant interplay, and I think the feeling I most wanted to give was this feeling of as you get older, how all these things just get heavier, how there's so much layered upon it, both your sense of do I have a destiny, and then all the choices you've made, and the pressure of free will on top of all that. And so for Feliu, he is a more burdened character, and it gets more difficult as he gets older.
And you provide some interesting characters to be sort of counterpart to this, or counterpoint, I should say, to this, you know, struggle that's constantly going on through the main character.
That's what I was going to say, too. Yeah, then I have my pianist, whose name is Justo Alcaraz, or El Nene. And for him, these intellectual things are not the same kind of struggle, because he's just a flamboyant, larger-than-life, fun-loving character, you know, a womanizer sometimes plays the fool. He's sort of my Sancho Panza. And although he can also be very wise, like a Sancho Panza. And for him, he's the type of character who you know, loves himself and feels, of course, he's destined for greatness. And his frustration is when other people get in the way of that greatness. So, and his goal in this novel is to compose. The problem is that his audience is not as interested in his compositions because, you know, they're Britney Spears. They just want him to be the silly celebrity. And of course, that's fun for him too. So he plays that up and then hates himself for playing that up because really he wants to leave something more lasting. So unlike Feliu, he's not torn in all these political directions. Also, he ends up getting stuck in some political situations. But Al-Saraz would have been happy just to be a composer and to leave behind Spanish music.
Was he inspired by any particular historical figure? Or?
Less so. Musically, he's inspired by a pianist who lived earlier named Albéniz. And so you can see the similarity in their last names, Albéniz, Al-Saraz. Albéniz was also a large man, a more flamboyant man. But then as far as the real personality of Al-Saraz, that's more of a imaginary construction.
The mentor is another fascinating character I found, and obviously a very important character since he's introduced so early on in the story.
Okay, and this is probably Alberto in Barcelona.
Right.
For me, there's a whole long... Feliu is passed between all these different kinds of teachers. He has a teacher early on, Eduardo Rivera, who is kind of just a sniveling young violin teacher who doesn't really teach him all that much. And then he has this wiser cello teacher later, Alberto in Barcelona.
Who's also an anarchist.
Who is, and who's gotten himself into some trouble and who has mixed feelings on politics. But he perhaps has been involved in some things that he's not proud to have been involved in. That's one of the little mysterious elements in the story. And yeah, he's a character I liked very much too. And then there's also, in my mind, all the women in the story are really tutors or mentors of another kind too. Everything from the mother to a young woman that Feliu has a short-lived affair with, to the queen, who is one of my favorite characters, and then later on, this Italian violinist, Aviva, that he does fall in love with. So it's one of those stories where someone is kind of passed along and has to learn from all these different people.
Did you, going into this, had you spent time in Spain or been, you know, immersed in the Spanish culture and history much prior to taking on the book?
Well, my first trip to Spain was when I was 15, and that was my first independent travel. I'd been to Europe before when I was 13 with a friend, but then I went back on my own when I was 15 and spent some time in Barcelona. And probably saw it a little bit as my character sees it. You know, if you come to a big city as a young person, you're overwhelmed by the crowds and trying to find your way. And so I would, you know, stay at the hostels and sit in the cafes with a Spanish novel and a Spanish dictionary trying to puzzle my way through it. So that was my first experience in Spain. And it really, I loved it. And I've been interested in Iberian culture and Mexican culture, Hispanic culture ever since then. For this book, I went back to Spain to do more purposeful research, to go to all those places that are mentioned in the book, places like Barcelona, Madrid, Granada. So in some cases, I knew I would be writing about these places, and so I wanted to describe them accurately. In other cases, I was still fishing around looking for, can the story change, or this has to happen, where should it happen?
Mm-hmm.
And that's wonderful. I mean, that's one of the great perks of writing a historical novel, is getting to go on a tour of the palace and getting to go visit behind the scenes of the opera house and, you know, getting to eat tapas. It's great.
Have you, did you bounce ideas off of any of your Spanish acquaintances to get a feel from them whether, you know, you were sort of on the right track?
Never. No way.
You'd still be discussing it, right?
I would not bounce ideas off anyone. Even my husband didn't read this book until it was done.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, I had an agent who read the first 15 pages, but those changed quite a bit.
So you're one of these writers who just locks themselves away and goes at it?
Yeah, because during the process, I'm really talking to myself, and it takes a lot of conversations trying to say, now, does this make sense, and what would happen, and what am I trying to say, and, you know, just going in circles, and I don't really like to share that with anyone until it's, you know, I want their full attention that you're only going to get maybe once, so I don't want to work it through in little pieces. Now, as far as sharing it with a Spanish audience, to tell you the truth, I thought their reaction would be, how dare an American come and tell our story? And I was actually quite surprised that it's going to be translated in 10 languages. It's already in, it came out already in Italian and Dutch, but it's going to be coming out this year in a Spanish edition in Spain and in a Catalan edition. So that was a real surprise to me, and I'm sure they would change many things in the book, but they must have seen it as a somewhat authentic story.
Well, I think there's, again, I've said this earlier in the interview, that there's just a lot. You've jammed a lot into this book and on a lot of different levels. And so I would find it hard to believe that there wouldn't be audiences anywhere that wouldn't find something, you know, appealing about it. As an artist yourself, a cellist and a writer, you know, you've written a book that talks about sort of the internal world of the artist as it responds to the outside world. What effect has writing this novel had on your own worldview and perspective as an artist and how you feel to relate to things?
Well, I think I keep seeing things politically. Even when I try to pull away, I'm always working on several novel ideas at a time. I'm in the middle of my next novel. But I'll tell you, I keep getting pulled to more current pressing things. I mean, I'm not sure how specific I want to get, but there's things happening in Iraq and Guantanamo Bay and things that I see happening in the minds of friends and neighbors and relatives, how people are reacting to the politics of our day. And I'm in the middle of a novel that happens to take place in 1870s London, and so part of my mind is there, but I'm still getting pulled up right to our present day as well. So I think, like my characters, there is this constant question of not trying to write politically on purpose, because, you know, it's not that sort of purposeful should, but that's where my mind and my heart is. I mean, there's things that bother me, and I'm asking these questions, and before I know it, I have a character in my mind who can deal with it more dramatically. You know, when you try to have a conversation with somebody, just a fact-based conversation, you throw out your facts, they throw out theirs, you have one anecdote, they have an anecdote, you don't seem to get very far. There's not a lot of change that I've seen, a change in opinion. But when somebody reads a whole story where, you know, for hours they inhabit the mind of a character, they seem more open to really considering another view. So I do find myself drawn in that direction in writing about sort of the events that matter to me that are happening right now.
It's always hard when you're in the middle. It's hard for us to really assess what's going on around us in terms of, you know, a longer view, where we're all going to be when the history books are written, as our president likes to say. And there's also, I think, a tendency to look behind us into the past and think somehow things were better back then. And in reading this, of course, one of the ways that we've already talked about, there's this incredible collection of people, incredibly talented artists who step up and become involved in the key issues of the time, the fight against fascism and what have you. Do you see a similar cast of characters coming out of our current society? I mean, we do have the Hollywood stars who come out and say they're against the war, but do you think that the art community today is getting as engaged, even if they're not visibly involved, are they engaging themselves in these sort of discussions that your characters are engaged in?
Well, I'm not an expert on that. I would just say I think so, and I hope so. But just like you were saying, it's so hard to judge in the present day. I mean, that's, I think, why I get pulled from the present day back into the historical, because at least then you can look back and get a better sense. So just to take an example, the Hollywood celebrities, when you're right in the moment, it's hard to tell, you know, is this someone who is just doing it because it's helping their reputation or it's getting them on the cover of a magazine? And it can sometimes take a few years to see which of those people actually stay with it and do meaningful work. And I know there's, you know, there's probably some celebrities who I would have written off 3 or 5 years ago thinking they were just doing it for the press. And then you see they're still at it. And that over time, you know, whether it's, you know, really current issues, you know, dealing with the Bush administration or say working in Africa, you know, you see only after a while which ones have made a real meaningful effort. And I think especially right now we have this tendency, we both, you know, we love our celebrities and we want to write them off at the same time. So they're stuck in a bind. You know, they're expected to have opinions, but then they're, you know, it's assumed that they're kind of superficial people and maybe their opinions aren't well thought out. And yet they have this platform. I mean, that's what's the same for my characters in the early 1900s in Spain and, say, celebrities today. They realize that they have the public's attention and what are they going to do with it? And some will do nothing and some will step forward and you know, we'll see.
You mentioned you're doing a book on London, 1870. Is there anything else you can tell us about that?
I'll tell you a little bit about. Sure. It's about a Victorian archaeologist. It's, again, based on, inspired by a real person who was a self-trained archaeologist. He taught himself to read cuneiform, which amazes me. How do you teach yourself to read cuneiform?
That's impressive.
And he did some of this just on his lunch hours visiting the British Museum. So, of course, last year I had to go to the British Museum. I wanted to see what tablets he was looking at, you know, under natural light. How could he have seen these little impressions in the baked clay, and how could he have figured this out? So the story starts with him, and he is the one who deciphered the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Oh.
And that's our oldest piece of literature.
Right.
Predates the Bible. And what I'm interested in, and this has contemporary parallels as well, is when he found the Epic of Gilgamesh, there was this 11th tablet that told a story that was very much like the Noah's flood story, except it was a more ancient version. And so in Victorian society, this created some excitement. There were people who thought, well, keep going, you know, find the rest of the missing pieces, find out more about this because it's going to confirm the Bible. And then there were other people that said, you're not supposed to be doing this. The Bible is supposed to be unique and without error. You're not supposed to be going to historical sources. You're kind of blaspheming the Bible. So really, this is a story that looks at this character's own issues of faith and science and how those things conflict sometimes. And that's an issue going on today,
I was going to say, it seems very contemporary sort of situation again.
And I think that's what happens. I think that it's very hard to pick a story set today that deals with something head on without just chasing away the very people you want to write for, but set it a century ago and somebody can say, well, how would I feel if I were that archaeologist finding that tablet? You know, what does that say about the Bible?
Mm-hmm.
And if I started questioning the Bible, you know, what would happen in that time? And here's an interesting story. When I was at the British Museum, I was talking to some of the curators there. And, you know, in the UK, they're actually quite a bit less religious than we are in America. And I tried to explain some of my ideas to them. And they said, well, I don't really get it. People aren't religious today. No one takes the Bible literally today. So, well, in America, a lot of people
do. It's a little different story.
It is different. So we're actually more Victorian than they are in some way. The conflict is very real for us.
Well, I'm looking forward to that when it hits the book stands. This is Dave Mazza. I've been speaking with Andromeda Romano Lax, author of The Spanish Bow. I want to thank you, Andromeda, for coming in today and talking with us about this great book, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Oh, thanks for having this conversation with me. It was fun.
And thank you for coming to KBOO.